KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. India launched missiles deep into Pakistan, and Pakistan claims it took down 5 Indian aircraft in response. International groups ask both sides to pull back, but will they? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Israel says it wants to push Gazans to the Egyptian border and allow aid only in zones controlled by its military. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We'll ask Israel's ambassador to the United Nations about the plan that the UN has rejected. Also, as President Trump calls for tariffs to help Hollywood, we'll ask, why have so many productions moved elsewhere? It is Wednesday, May 7th. On this day in 1992, the 27th Amendment was ratified. It requires a waiting period between congressional raises. It was proposed in 1789, but obviously it took a while to get through. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Roman Catholic cardinals have held a public mass in St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican. They're returning to the Sistine Chapel to open their conclave. The cardinals will now go into seclusion to choose the next pope. Fresh fighting has erupted between India and Pakistan. India has fired missiles into Pakistan. India says it's retaliating for a deadly militant attack last month. India's Foreign Secretary Vikram Misri says his country targeted 9 Pakistani sites he claims are linked to terrorist groups.
These actions were measured, non-escalatory, proportionate, and responsible. They focused on dismantling the terrorist infrastructure and disabling terrorists likely to be sent across to India.
He was heard on the BBC. Pakistan says it had no link to last month's militant attack. Pakistan is claiming it has shot down some Indian warplanes, but this has not been confirmed. A jury is continuing deliberations this morning in the second-degree state murder trial involving 3 former Memphis, Tennessee police officers. The men are accused in the beating death of black motorist Tyree Nichols. From member station WKNO, Katie Reardon reports jurors were repeatedly shown camera footage from the violent arrest.
The police surveillance footage captured officers in January 2023 restraining, kicking, and punching Nichols as they take him into custody following a traffic stop. He died 3 days later. 2 of the 5 men originally indicted, who are also black, have agreed to plead guilty. In closing statements Monday, prosecutor Melanie Headley said everyone had a duty to intervene.
They're all out there. We're all doing it together.
Attorneys for the defendant say Nichols resisted them and that officers struggled to handcuff him due to the heavy use of pepper spray and chaos of the arrest. For NPR News, I'm Katie Reardon.
New research is underscoring the risk of carcinogens that are found in commonly used personal care products such as lotions and shampoo. The study has been published today in the journal Environmental Science and Technology Letters. NPR's Will Stone reports the study focuses on chemicals that release formaldehyde.
The label may not say formaldehyde, but that lotion or soap might still contain preservatives that release formaldehyde. In fact, the study found among black and Latina women, more than half were using products with these chemicals. The 2 most common were DMDM hydantin and diazolidinol urea. The study's author is Robin Dodson, a researcher at Silent Spring Institute.
It's important that people know when they're exposed to a carcinogen, because really there's no safe level.
Dodson says their analysis of an EPA consumer product database shows that 8% of personal care products had formaldehyde or formaldehyde-releasing chemicals. Will Stone, NPR News.
On Wall Street in pre-market trading, Dow futures are higher. This is NPR. The historically stable Taiwan dollar has strengthened against the U.S. dollar at its fastest clip in decades. This is a sign of uneasiness over concern about the stability of the U.S. economy. NPR's Emily Fang reports the concern is based on multiple rounds of tariffs imposed by President Trump, including on Taiwan.
Worries about the U.S. have led Taiwanese insurance companies and pension funds to sell off their U.S. dollar-backed securities, leading in part to an 8% gain of the Taiwanese dollar against the U.S. dollar. Taiwan sent a delegation for its first round of tariff negotiations with the U.S. this month. Taiwan buys more and more U.S. goods, but it does have a trade surplus with the U.S. because the U.S. buys so many advanced semiconductor chips made on the Asian island. A weaker U.S. dollar would actually help make U.S. exports to Taiwan cheaper. That the U.S. asked the Taiwan government to intentionally depreciate the U.S. dollar against the Taiwanese currency. Taiwan's central bank explicitly denied this. Emily Fang, NPR News.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent will discuss President Trump's tariffs this weekend with Chinese economic officials in Switzerland. Bessent says the goal is to de-escalate the trade situation with China. For the second time, in just over a week, a U.S. fighter jet assigned to the USS Harry S. Truman has been lost in the Red Sea. The F/A-18 Super Hornet failed to land on the deck after an equipment failure. The jet tumbled into the water. The crew aboard ejected safely. Last week, another fighter jet was being towed aboard the Truman when it fell overboard. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. In a few minutes, I'll speak with Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, Danny Danon. We'll talk about his country's latest plans for Gaza.
First, though, Indians and Pakistanis had been waiting for or dreading this moment.
India struck multiple targets across Pakistan in the most extensive strikes in more than 50 years. It comes after India blamed Pakistan for an attack that killed 26 people in late April. Pakistan denies any connection. Its military has retaliated by firing into parts of Indian-held Kashmir, and it claims it has downed five Indian aircraft. The Associated Press reports that more than 30 people were killed in Pakistan. India says three people were killed on their side.
On the line with us is NPR's Dia Hadid. She covers Pakistan and India from her base in Mumbai. Dia, tell us about these strikes. They happened overnight there.
Yeah, and most people were sleeping, but a resident near one of the worst hit places in southern Pakistan recorded this audio. And even in a nearby town, one resident said the strikes woke up his family. This is Ajaz Rao.
My family would wake up and they say something is very strange is happening, that not just one blast, there were a number of blasts. So windows were shaking.
Wow. So what kind of places was India targeting in Pakistan?
Well, India's army says it struck militant training camps and what they call terror infrastructure. And many of those strikes were in Pakistani-held Kashmir. Kashmir is that Himalayan territory divided between India and Pakistan. It's claimed by both, and it's at the heart of nearly every conflict between the two countries. But Pakistan says the strikes mostly hit mosques and part of a hydropower dam. One prominent Pakistani militant says one of the strikes targeted his relatives and killed 14 people, including women and children. And that was in a small town in southern Pakistan. And It's really important to say here where these strikes took place. Some were deep in Pakistan. One was near the country's second largest city. So here, have a listen to Michael Kugelman. He writes the Foreign Policy's weekly South Asia brief, and he says this hasn't happened in decades.
The airstrikes that India has launched into Pakistan are the deepest into Pakistani territory since 1971. What also stands out about these recent strikes is the scale and intensity of them.
And analysts I've spoken to say they were actually expecting India to hit hard.
Expecting them? Why were they expecting that?
Well, just because of the nature of the attack that triggered these renewed tensions. It happened on April 22 when gunmen attacked Indian tourists in a meadow. And it seems some of the gunmen targeted Hindu men. It was the deadliest attack against civilians in years. And the victims came from all over India, so it just really triggered widespread anger. But after the strikes, the Indian military said its response was measured, focused, and non-escalatory. Analysts say those words signal that India is not interested in escalating this further.
Now, could all this maybe quiet down, or do folks there expect more military actions?
I guess the problem here is with strikes so deep in Pakistan and with this death toll, Pakistan may feel like it must respond to show people that its army isn't weak. So analyst Praveen Donti with the International Crisis Group says other countries have to step in.
I'm afraid if the international community doesn't step in, especially the US, then we're only seeing the beginning of these escalatory strikes.
For now, President Trump has said he hopes this ends quickly, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he's closely monitoring the situation.
That's NPR's Dia Hadid in Mumbai. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The Israeli cabinet approved a plan this week that would confine Gaza's population, about 2.3 million people, to a narrow strip of land near the Egyptian border. Food and supplies would be provided by U.S. security contractors and distributed by as yet undetermined humanitarian aid organizations. The Israeli government says this is the only way it will allow aid back into Gaza, where most supplies have been blocked for the last 2 months. Meanwhile, a far-right member of the government, the finance minister, said the Gaza Strip will be totally destroyed under the plan. Joining us now for more on this is Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, Danny Danon. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Michelle.
So the government has said that U.S. contractors will directly oversee distribution of aid in what it calls sterile zones under Israeli military control. Have any contractors agreed to this? If so, who are they?
Well, we are still developing this program. And I was shocked to see the response coming from the United Nations. Even before we presented the plan, we heard the Secretary General and his team saying that they will not cooperate with any initiative coming from Israel. That's weird for a humanitarian organization that's supposed to think about solutions. They decide to become political. But we are determined. We are determined to bring back the hostages. Unfortunately, we don't see the negotiations moving forward. And we said it very clear. We will not end the war with 59 people left behind. We will do whatever is needed to bring all the hostages back home. As we speak, there are 59 hostages in captivity for more than 18 months. So we will do whatever it takes.
As you just mentioned, the United Nations and aid groups have already rejected this new approach, saying that this is going to mean that large numbers of people won't be able to get basic supplies. They say it doesn't adhere to global humanitarian principles and that the government is using humanitarian relief as a military strategy. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think it's political. I would expect them to engage, to meet with me, to have a dialogue, to raise their concerns. By the way, in the last 18 months, that's what happened. We had a mechanism that we had dialogue about many, many issues. We solved many problems together, and we have the same goal. You know, we want to ease the suffering of those who are not involved in terror activities in Gaza. But at the same time, I believe we have to do whatever is needed to win this war and to eradicate Hamas. So hearing this approach of not negotiating or not engaging, I think they feel in a different planet, maybe thinking that we will end the war, forget about the hostages and move on. We are not going to move on, Michelle, with the hostages behind.
Yesterday, I spoke with Shana Lowe of the Norwegian Refugee Council. That's one of the groups that's already distributing aid in Gaza, or has been, as their supplies are dwindling. This is how she described the government's plan.
We are eager to serve people, but we also know that aid cannot and should not be weaponized in order to move civilian populations or achieve military goals. And that's a red line that we are just unwilling to cross.
So, Ambassador, is that the goal here, to drive people to the south of the Strip so that Israel can occupy the north?
But first, let me clarify, you know, what we have seen in the past, that Hamas took advantage of the aid. And everyone you will speak with in Gaza, with honest, will tell you that the aid went to Hamas. We have testimonies of people who came out of captivity, that they saw Hamas taking advantage of the trucks, selling them, and the aid didn't get to the people. So I think what we are trying to do now is to build a mechanism that will allow the people to receive aid, but it will not be through Hamas.
The allegation here is that the goal here is to drive people to this particular strip. And in fact, the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, basically said as much. He said that the Gaza Strip will be totally destroyed under the plan. Is that not true?
No, I think what we will try to do is to minimize civilian casualties, like we did before. So we will encourage the population to move to areas that we will not be fighting there. There will be humanitarian areas, humanitarian zones, where they will be able to meet NGOs, receive aid, and they will be safe over there. And the area that they will be evacuated, we will fight. And we know when you have a fight area, a war zone, it's not safe. So we will encourage the population to move out from those areas while we are fighting Hamas.
Oh, so Ambassador, if I could just clarify this for this moment. Are you saying that it is not true that Israel is engaging this particular aid distribution scheme in order to reoccupy Gaza? Are you saying that that is just not true?
Absolutely not. It's not the goal of this war. We have no intention to stay in Gaza. Our goals are very clear, to bring the hostages back and to eliminate Hamas. We have no desire to stay in Gaza. We left Gaza in 2005 completely. We don't intend to go back there.
That is Danny Danon. He's Israel's ambassador to the United Nations. Ambassador, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
The Federal Reserve has two big jobs, fighting inflation while also keeping a lid on unemployment. That could be especially challenging right now as a result of President Trump's trade war. As its rate-setting committee wraps its two-day meeting today, the Fed is expected to do nothing. NPR's Scott Horsley explains.
The Fed's main tool for fighting inflation and unemployment is to adjust interest rates. When prices are climbing too fast, the central bank raises rates to tamp down demand and bring inflation under control. When unemployment's going up, the Fed lowers rates to goose the economy and put people back to work. But what to do in the face of a trade war that threatens to drive up prices and unemployment at the same time?
Oh my gosh, literally between the rock and the hard place. What do you do with this?
Economist Mark Zandi of Moody's Analytics says President Trump's tariffs could be a double whammy for both the economy and the central bank.
These tariffs mean higher inflation, no doubt about it. That argues for higher rates, and then this is going to hurt growth. We're talking recession. That means lower rates. So what do you do with that? And you really don't know where policy is headed.
For now, Fed policymakers are expected to hold rates steady, where they've been since the end of last year. That's despite President Trump's frequent demand for lower interest rates. Inflation is still a little higher than the Fed would like, making a rate cut unlikely for now. And so far, at least, the job market is looking okay. All of that could change if the trade war drags on. Fed policymakers will have another chance to adjust interest rates next month. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
on the next Fresh Air, how the Trump family's business ventures capitalize on the president's position and stand to directly benefit him. This includes foreign deals from luxury hotels in Dubai and Serbia to the Trump cryptocurrency company. New York Times reporter Eric Lipton tells us why these deals pose unprecedented conflicts of interest. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Proven Winners with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/iulab. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. President Trump says he wants to put tariffs on movies made outside the United States. He told reporters the American film industry is dying and he wants to bring show business jobs back.
Our film industry has been decimated by other countries.
As NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports, locations around the globe have been jockeying for production business.
On a soundstage in downtown L.A., the cast and crew of the Netflix series The Lincoln Lawyer are taping a courtroom scene for an upcoming season 4 episode.
Background! Action!
The Lincoln Lawyer is a legal drama set in Los Angeles, so having its production based at the Los Angeles Center Studios is convenient and saves money, says Stephen Jaworski. He's in charge of budgeting for the series as vice president of production for A&E Studios.
We just kind of base here and then go to City Hall or wherever it is we're filming.
Jaworski says the studio's 6 sound stages are nearly half empty these days. Long before this week's tariff announcement, he was worried that so many productions have left Los Angeles.
The reality is this show could be shot anywhere. LA is a character to our story, and it would be very hard for me to see the show leave LA, but could it be produced somewhere else? Yes. And I think as costs increase, whether it's inflation or the way the economy may be going, there may be a mandate of you have to cut your costs, and the only way to keep the show going would to be relocate. It would be heartbreaking if the show had to leave.
For decades, many TV and film productions have ditched LA and all of California for other locales, seduced by generous tax credits, rebates, and grants. Georgia, for example, gives producers a 20% tax credit if they film or shoot in the state, and 10% more for a peach logo in the credits. Most states offer some sort of financial enticement, so do nearly 100 countries, including Canada, the UK, Ireland, and Australia.
Even places like Thailand, White Lotus shot entirely in Thailand. So what's great for producers today is with the number of incentives here in the US and around the world, they really have a lot of choices.
Joe Chianese is senior vice president at Entertainment Partners, a global production services company. He consults with producers about available production laws, incentives, and taxes around the world.
It's a mobile industry that can spend a lot of money at one time, which is a real stimulant to the economy, creating jobs.
Chianese says the trend of what's known as runaway production began in the late 1990s.
Productions were looking for jurisdictions that had lower labor costs and lower production costs, so productions were going to Canada. And then in 97, Canada introduced credits, which made it extremely popular. And then you saw that rolling out in other countries.
Ever since, there's been a global competition for entertainment jobs and bragging rights. Even Marvel movies have been filming in the UK. They used to film in Georgia. And even within the US, states are racing to get that show business work.
Small fraction of Texas budget surplus could turn this state into the new Hollywood.
In a recent video, Woody Harrelson teamed up with other famous actors, Matthew McConaughey, Billy Bob Thornton, Dennis Quaid, and Renee Zellweger. They're supporting a state bill offering more tax credits in Texas.
I'm talking about a whole new hub for film and television, a renaissance, a rebirth.
How about a wholesale takeover?
No shade to Texas, but I think people would rather film in California.
Jaworski is one of many in the industry making the case for production to return to California.
The situation is so dire that if something's not done this summer, I truly believe California being the entertainment capital of the world and the production capital of the world, I think that will be a thing of the past, honestly.
Jaworski says he supports California Governor Gavin Newsom's push to more than double the state's tax credits for production, and he's lobbied for two bills now circulating in the state legislature. They would allow more types of productions to take advantage of the incentives. State Senator Ben Allen, who represents part of L.A., co-authored one of those bills. He says he wants to know more about Trump's plan to bring movie productions back to the U.S.
Other countries have been throwing money at these productions to coax them away. So there's a part of me that's very intrigued by the idea. Now, of course, you know, the devil is in the details, as with so many policy proposals.
This week, after Trump's tariff announcement shocked global film industries, Governor Newsom volunteered to partner with the president to craft a $7.5 billion federal tax credit program to, quote, make America film again. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Andre 3000 is undergoing a transformation.
On the oak tree, I hope we feel like this forever, 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 ever, forever, ever, forever. Never seems that long until you're grown.
As half of the duo Outkast, he became one of the most decorated rappers of his day. But a couple of years ago, he shocked fans, including NPR music reporter Rodney Carmichael.
All of a sudden, the best rapper alive is playing the flute.
Yeah, that's right. Andre 3000 released a solo album of jazz flute. No rapping at all.
And on Monday, he took another step away from hip-hop by dropping a surprise collection of improvised piano. The album is called Seven Piano Sketches, and some are just 2 minutes or less.
Recorded on his iPhone, mostly over a decade ago.
Andre 3000 shared a few details on his Instagram page. He said originally the title was the best worst rap album in history because, you know, well, no lyrics.
And when it came to creating these sketches, he wrote, I spread my fingers out on the keys and randomly, but with purpose, move them around until I find something that feels good or interesting.
The same day Andre 3000 released his piano sketches, he showed up at the Met Gala wearing a piano strap to his back. Fashionable and good promotion.
Rodney Carmichael says Andre's personality changed with practically every Outkast album, so he thinks we shouldn't be too surprised by another radical change.
Maybe when you reach his level of, you know, whether you want to call it creative genius or, you know, just excellence, you either have to figure out how to keep surpassing expectations or totally subverting them.
This is NPR News.
One of the challenges that the conclave's selection for Pope will face is how to make the Catholic Church appealing and relevant to future generations.
Whenever the church moves forward, it does so by looking back and drawing on the best of its tradition.
I'm Elsa Chang. How young Catholics are thinking about the church during the papal transition on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. India is defending today's missile attack against Pakistan.
India has demonstrated considerable restraint in its response.
That's Vyomika Singh, a wing commander with India's Air Force. Pakistan says the attack left at least 26 people dead, including a child. The country's prime minister is describing the attack as an act of war. India says it targeted infrastructure used by militants it blames for last month's assault in Indian-controlled Kashmir. That attack left more than 24 people dead, mostly Hindu tourists. Pakistan denies supporting those militants. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is calling for an investigation into the hundreds of flight delays and cancellations at Newark Liberty International Airport in New Jersey in recent days. Officials in part are pointing to shortages of air traffic controllers, outdated technology, and the closure of an airport runway. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz has more.
Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said the issues at the airport just show the nation's air traffic control system is badly in need of updating. He said that later this week, the administration will present a new plan to do just that.
United Airlines recently canceled 35 daily round-trip flights at Newark, citing safety concerns. This is NPR News. An F-18 attempting to land on the USS Truman yesterday ended up in the Red Sea, reportedly because of a problem with the carrier's equipment on the flight deck. The two pilots ejected safely and were rescued by helicopter with minor injuries. Less than 2 weeks ago, an F-18 slipped off the Truman's hangar deck into the sea. Starting today, airline passengers at the nation's airports are being asked to show their real ID before boarding domestic flights. NPR's Martin Costi says the picture IDs meet federal standards set by Congress 20 years ago.
From now on, the only state IDs valid for air travel are those marked with a star or a U.S. flag, indicating tougher vetting of a person's ID. It also means the person is in the country legally. Brian Zimmer is a former congressional researcher who wrote the Real ID law, which allows states to also issue plane driver's licenses to people who don't have legal immigration status.
It's legal federally to do that, but it's not legal for someone bearing one of those IDs to fly on an airplane. And that's the big deal of the deadline.
19 states issue these plane IDs, but last month the Trump administration sent a letter criticizing states that have, quote, issued driver's licenses to individuals present in the United States in violation of federal immigration law. Martin Costi, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow's up 212 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The papal conclave is beginning today at the Vatican.
133 cardinal electors are undertaking the solemn task of choosing the next leader of the Catholic Church.
Joining me from outside St. Peter's Square in Rome is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Jason, so let's start by just telling us what's happening throughout the day there.
Well, as much as there have been lots of conversations about church politics and global affairs, today
is a day of religious ceremony and spiritual preparation leading up to the votes. A morning mass in St. Peter's Basilica, which is the only public event, a procession from the Vatican's Pauline Chapel to the Sistine Chapel while chanting the Litany of Saints, the hymn Veni Creator Spiritus to invoke the Holy Spirit, then an oath while touching the Gospels, the call Extra Omnes sending out all those not directly involved in the election, a final sermon, and then the voting begins.
Wow. All right, now you've spoken with one of the cardinals who will be voting. What'd you hear from him?
Well, Cardinal Michael Czerny is a Canadian Jesuit who has worked here at the Vatican under Pope Francis. This is his first time participating in the conclave. He's only been a cardinal since 2019 when Francis made him one. He says that cardinals are not focusing on the politics of the church or of the world when they're making this decision.
It's neither the person in the sense of the individual qualities, nor is it the issues. Voting is not based on calculation. Our voting is based on openness to the Holy Spirit.
Czerny stressed several times with me that he considers this election a religious experience, not primarily a political one. And I think that's something we don't pay enough attention to in secular culture, and what makes the outcome so unpredictable.
Yeah. Now, what have the cardinals been talking about amongst themselves in the days leading up to today?
Well, it's clear from what the Vatican has been telling us about these meetings that are happening with the cardinals that they are serious issues of war and peace, migration and climate change. But Cardinal Czerny says he's not anxious.
The church herself is the expression of God's love for us in history. We're not lost or not orphans. We are in God's hands, and we believe that God will act among us and we will have the Holy Father he wants us to have.
But still, the Vatican is also telling us that the cardinals are discussing internal problems, church finances, clergy sex abuse, as well as divisions within the church over doctrine.
Now, Jason, you're in Rome right now, but you mainly cover religion in the United States. So what can you tell us about the relationship of American Catholics to the papacy and to that doctrine that you mentioned?
Well, about 20% of Americans identify as Catholic, and large majorities hold views that contradict official church teachings from the Pope. One example, Pew Research finds that even though abortion is considered a grave sin within Catholicism, 6 in 10 American Catholics believe abortion should be legal in all or most cases. Despite disagreeing with church teaching, many American Catholics keep a close eye on who the Pope is because he sets the tone and the agenda for the whole church. So as we look at this conclave, more progressive Catholics might be delighted by someone like Pope Francis because of his focus on issues like poverty, migration, and the environment. At the same time, more conservative Catholics are looking for someone more traditional, focused on that church doctrine.
That's NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose in Rome. Jason, thank you.
You're welcome.
Traffic at major trading hubs in Southern California is down a lot. The ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach are together the largest port complex in the U.S. And in the month or so since President Trump ratcheted up tariffs against Chinese goods, port officials had been predicting a drop in cargo. Now, this week, they said it fell by more than a third compared to the same week last year. Steve Futterman reports on how that's affecting the people whose livelihoods are connected to the ports.
Yesterday, outside the Longshore Union's dispatch hall, around 70 to 80 people who typically load and unload shipping containers were milling around. They were hoping for assignments. 39-year-old Charlie Camacho is one of those who came looking for work. It's becoming harder to find.
Less volume of cargo containers means less work for us, so yeah, we feel it. We definitely feel it.
Usually, when Camacho shows up, he gets jobs. Not right now.
Give me the realistic odds of getting work today.
It's like 25%, maybe.
When people like Camacho don't work, it impacts others. Frank Grove sells gloves and safety gear to dock workers and says his business is down nearly 75%.
No sales at all, really. If they're not working, I don't make no money.
The immediate impact of the cargo decline affects virtually every business around the ports. Trucking, shipping companies, distribution centers, and others. Rob Walpole is the CEO of Custom Goods. His company handles shipments of products once they arrive in the U.S.
We've seen significant reductions of import shipping volumes into this country. That means significant less volumes that we'll be handling on behalf of our customers.
The situation's not good.
That's Gene Soroka, the executive director of the Port of LA.
Cargo volume this week for imports is down 35% compared to last year. People are quite concerned, absolutely.
He says this doesn't just affect people who work directly with the port.
The impact the Port of Los Angeles has on the city, the region, and the country cannot be understated. The cargo that moves through this port reaches not only all 50 states, but each one of our 435 congressional districts.
According to Soroka, big importers say shoppers could start to see shortages in 4 to 6 weeks once inventory that was stockpiled ahead of the tariffs runs out.
You name it, they all come through our ports.
Sal DiCostanzo is with the major union here, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 13.
Foods come and go, medical supplies, manufacturing components, finished products.
Diane Middleton is a former member of the LA City Harbor Commission, which oversees the port. She says even if the tariffs were lifted today, it would take time for the supply chain to recover.
They don't just have ships lined up like taxi cabs. Once you've cut all that off, you can't bring it back in a minute.
She also worries that in the long term, trade could be forever changed. She says many countries, especially China, may be finding new and more dependable destinations for their goods, and they may choose to ship less to the U.S. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman at the Port of Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
Israel's war with Hamas is far from over. Reaction to Israel's potential expansion of the ground campaign in Gaza, next time on Here and Now.
Did you know you can access the world of public radio? The latest news, standout podcasts, captivating stories, just by speaking? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Blues guitarist Joe Louis Walker has died. He was 75. He started performing when he was 16 and was quickly opening for Thelonious Monk and Muddy Waters. Walker was known for his electric stage presence. He recorded dozens of solo albums, some live. He was known for mixing all sorts of genres and blues styles, cementing himself as one of the greats of blues. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. A lot of U.S. prisons are closing down after the industry went through a building boom decades ago. It was a complicated calculus with a lot of social impact, but it's also hit the economic fortunes of rural America hard. North Country Public Radio's Emily Russell has this report.
To understand where we are today, we have to go back in time, back to the early 1970s. Crime was on the rise, and the country had started its war on drugs. So states like New York began passing strict new drug laws that doled out long prison sentences. New York's prison population went from 12,000 in 1970 to more than 72,000 by 1999. Most of the people newly convicted were Black and brown men, and the state needed somewhere to send them all. So it turned to small towns upstate.
Why did you want to bring a state prison to Moriah?
Jobs. You know, we needed the jobs.
Tom Scazzafava was the town supervisor of Moriah in the late 80s. The community of about 5,000 people had been struggling for years. The prison provided a boost.
There was a couple stores in Mineville that opened up, mom and pop stores. There was a drug store. New houses going up from correction officers that lived and worked here. And so there was a huge difference.
New York's governor at the time, Mario Cuomo, saw prisons as a solution to rising crime, but also as an economic boon for upstate. During his tenure, Cuomo opened 30 new prisons. Here he is at his 1985 State of the State address.
We've already built 4,500 new prison cells to house the criminals who were convicted under the state's tough new laws. We'll build another 4,100 in the next 2 years alone.
The number of prisons nationwide tripled in just three decades, but they weren't spread out equally among all states, according to Jacob Harris. He's a PhD candidate from Cornell University who studies prisons. Harris says states like New York, North Carolina, and Texas opened far more than most other places.
So instead of saying, let's just build a few large prisons, we're going to spread these prisons out in these rural areas, and so these rural areas can have jobs.
But then came the prison bust. In the mid-2000s, many strict drug laws were repealed, and prison populations began to plummet. When Mario Cuomo's son Andrew became governor of New York, he vowed to close prisons. Here he is at the 2011 State of the State address.
An incarceration program is not an employment program. If people need jobs, let's get people jobs.
Since that speech, the state has closed more than two dozen prisons. Harris's research shows New York, North Carolina, and Texas now account for a third of all prison closures in recent decades. Cuomo's successor, Governor Kathy Hochul, wants to close five more in the next year, in part to ease a staffing shortage amid a complicated moment for New York prisons. Eight officers are facing murder charges for the recent deaths of two inmates at two separate prisons. Meanwhile, officers went on a three-week wildcat strike earlier this spring, demanding safer working conditions. Prisons are deeply ingrained in the culture of upstate New York. That's why their closures hit especially hard. A few years after the prison closed in Moriah, Matthew Brassard took over as town supervisor.
Change is scary for a lot of people, including myself, but if we don't pivot into a different direction, we're just going to keep spiraling down, and eventually we won't have any businesses.
This community, like so many other former prison towns, now has to figure out what comes next. For NPR News, I'm Emily Russell in upstate New York.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Protests against the Gaza war are common in Israel. Every weekend, protesters demand a ceasefire deal and the release of Israeli hostages taken by Hamas during the October 7th attacks in 2023. But now a new group of protesters is trying to draw attention to the children killed in Gaza. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
Every Saturday night, throngs of protesters march down a main street, banging on drums and chanting. But last weekend, they fell quiet. As they streamed past another group of protesters who's brought something new to the Israeli debate over the war in Gaza. They're holding photos of children smiling. This new protest group says these are the children killed by the Israeli military in Gaza. Orit Ben David holds the photo of a young kid named Tahrir killed this march.
Most of the people in Israel do not know how many children were killed in Gaza, and I think it's a shame.
The latest count by Gaza health officials is that more than 16,000 children have been killed. The total death toll, they report, exceeds 52,000. Their photos are rarely seen in Israel. Here, images of the war feature the faces of Israelis, the hostages still in Gaza, and young soldiers killed there. One Israeli marching in support of the hostages wipes away tears. Her name is Miri Heeler.
When I see the picture of the children in Gaza, I cannot ignore it. When they're standing here and I see their faces, it's very hard because we don't want to harm the children in Gaza.
Her husband, Guy Heeler, says Israel is fighting a very different war more than a year and a half since the Hamas attack.
We stopped to defend ourselves. We are now avenging. It's a revenge.
It's a revenge
it's
now.
Just a revenge.
Now this war has to stop.
When Israel broke a ceasefire in March, it launched airstrikes in Gaza, killing more than 170 children, according to Gaza's civil defense group. That prompted this new protest. Organizer Noah Rashem.
I printed some photos in black and white in my home printer, and we came here and we stood. And there were like we were about 20 people.
As their numbers grew, the family of a hostage in Gaza objected to their presence. Israeli police issued a ban against protesters holding pictures of children from Gaza. After an outcry, police dropped the ban. The new protest group now draws several hundred people holding photos of children killed in Gaza. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Ever since the Taliban took over Kabul in 2021, roughly 10,000 Afghan migrants have settled in the Houston area. Since President Trump returned to office, he's been ending programs aimed at providing those migrants with legal status. That means some Afghans who helped the U.S. during the long war in Afghanistan now fear they might be forced to return to a country where they say their lives will be in danger. Here's Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider.
Syed Yaqub Katali spent years aiding U.S. forces as a security commander for the Afghan Interior Ministry in Herat Province. That's where he was when Afghanistan's government fell to the Taliban.
I went to Iran and I applied for a Brazil humanitarian visa. That was just the option that was left.
From Brazil, he, his wife, and two children crossed 9 international borders to get to Mexico.
In all this country, we got the legal paper that we can stay there.
While in Mexico, they got visas to enter the U.S. legally on parole while applying for asylum. Katali got a job as an apartment leasing agent, but then...
We got an email that we have to leave. We have 7 days after that, they're going to charge us $900.
$900?
$900 per day.
Katali's attorney told him not to worry, but he's still frightened for his future. He's not the only one. Muhammad Amiri is a former pilot trainee with the Afghan Air Force and a permanent resident. Amiri recently got engaged, but his fiance is still in Afghanistan. He doesn't dare go to visit her for fear he won't be allowed back into the U.S.
We feel threatened if they send us back to our country. It will be the same story. Feel threatened of to be tortured, maybe be killed by Taliban.
Roughly 200,000 Afghans have fled to the U.S. since the fall of Kabul using a variety of special visa programs. Recently, the Trump administration has been ending protections for those without permanent legal status. Immigration attorney Ali Zakaria says Trump is trying to fulfill his mass deportation campaign pledge.
What Trump administration's policy at this moment is to create this mass group that can be deported, and one way is to cancel the existing legal protocols or legal protections that are in place.
Previous attempts to aid former Afghan allies have failed in Congress. Khalil Yarzada is a former Afghan translator who became a U.S. citizen in February. Yarzada works for the veterans group Combined Arms. He says many of those allies put their lives on the line for U.S. troops and were promised help coming to America.
I think it is our duty as Americans to support them, to give them a fair shot, a fair chance to be able to build a life here in the United States, because this is the most American thing that we can do.
The Trump administration also announced that, effective May 20th, it's ending the program known as Temporary Protected Status for Afghans, an emergency status for migrants from countries where their lives might be in danger. In a written message, the Homeland Security Department said the situation in Afghanistan has improved. That's little reassurance to Katali, who entered the U.S. using the CBP One app before the administration shut down its asylum petition function.
I have a treatment letter. If I go back, like 100%, they're going to kill me and my family as well.
Texas Congressman Michael McCaul, a Republican who previously lobbied to support resettlement of Afghan allies in the U.S., issued a statement commending Trump for his efforts to root out terrorism. But McCaul added that the Taliban has made clear its determination for retribution. Until they demonstrate clear behavioral changes, he said, I urge the administration to continue prioritizing the safety of the Afghan men and women who risk their lives to help our troops. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.